Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and more legal news now. A federal court is hearing from victims of Barry Cadden. He's the former co-owner and head pharmacist at the New England Compounding Center in Framingham. Cadden was convicted this past March of racketeering and mail fraud following the deaths of at least 60 people and injuries to 700 others due to steroid injections that were contaminated with meningitis. Prosecutors say Cadden failed to properly supervise the manufacturing of the drugs and authorized shipments that were not sterilized and contained expired ingredients. Cadden was acquitted on the most serious charges of second-degree murder. As a federal judge prepares to sentence Cadden, WBUR senior reporter David Boeri asks, what did the jury really intend in this case?
Only the jurors know whether they actually acquitted pharmacist Barry Cadden on charges of second-degree murder. No one else knows because the judge has been holding on to their identities for 3 months now. And the reason there is a question is because the judge, Richard Stearns, never made sure the jurors were unanimous when they turned in a jury verdict form that made it look like they were split.
It is a gigantic mess. I think that that's the technical legal term that I would use to describe it.
That's trial and appellate lawyer and legal writer Harvey Silverglate. Other experts and observers describe what the jurors did as astonishing, because instead of simply checking off guilty or not guilty when the jurors considered the second-degree murder charges, they actually wrote how many jurors thought Cadden was guilty and how many thought he was not guilty for each charge. 9 guilty, 3 not guilty for some of them, 8 guilty, 4 not guilty for most of them. That's hardly unanimous, as federal verdicts require. And what the judge did when he saw the verdict form with those numbers was just as astonishing, says NYU law professor Stephen Gillers. He's an expert on judicial ethics and law governing trials.
It was incumbent on the judge to recognize immediately that he needed to consult with counsel.
But the judge did nothing of the sort. In fact, he did not tell the lawyers at all before the verdicts were read. Again, Harvey Silverglate.
The verdict on certain counts was unclear. The only way to clarify it was to bring the jurors back into the courtroom and ask them what they meant.
But the judge did not do that either. He simply accepted the verdicts of not guilty. Yet if the jurors were not unanimous, then they did not have a verdict. And if they did not have a verdict, they weren't finished deliberating. If they were hopelessly divided, they did not report it. So arguably, the judge discharged the jurors before they were done. It's too late to bring them back. Harvey Silverglate.
The judge obviously must have realized it was a problem. He sloughed it off, and now everybody's living with the consequence.
My name is Bill Thomas, and at the time of the outbreak, I lived in Ypsilanti, Michigan, and I received a tainted injection from Michigan pain specialists in Howell, Michigan.
One of 700 across the country who got sick, hiker and outdoorsman Bill Thomas says walking 100 yards now causes great pain. He's outraged the judge, quote, didn't bother to ask the jurors a couple of questions about what they meant to say with their verdicts.
He seems more concerned about the jury's discomfort than the fact that hundreds of people are sick and their lives have been changed and dozens of people are dead.
The maximum penalty on the counts for which Cadden was convicted is 20 years. But trying to make the best out of the judge's conduct, prosecutors argue that he should consider the jury's tell-all verdict form at sentencing. It shows that the majority of jurors voted guilty on the murder charges, and guilty verdicts would have carried the maximum penalty of life in prison. Prosecutors are proposing a sentencing standard based on preponderance of evidence, not the trial standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So even though Cadden was acquitted, he could still be punished as if he had been found guilty. This, too, comes as a consequence of Stern's response when the jurors handed him their seemingly contradictory verdict form. And Stern's insistence on keeping the jurors' identities a secret has also kept a secret of whether they actually acquitted Cadden. Again, Harvey Silverglate.
The judge's reason or rationalization is quite transparent. I think he doesn't want the press to interview the jurors because it could embarrass the judge.
The obligation of openness exists independent of whether people are going to be applauding the verdict, applauding the process, or criticizing the verdict and criticizing the process.
Robert Birchie is general counsel to the New England Newspaper and Press Association.
The fundamental principle is that this information belongs to the public so that the public can make independent judgments about how the system is working.
The ruling precedent of the Federal First Circuit, which includes Massachusetts, has long been that the identities of jurors are presumptively public. By practice, as former federal judge Nancy Gertner explains, the names and addresses of jurors have customarily been released 7 to 10 days after trial or sooner.
The presumptive rule is disclosure unless there's a reason not to that a judge can justify.
To withhold the names, judges are required to show particularized findings of a significant threat to the judicial process itself, such as the safety of jurors. Such findings have not been made by Judge Stearns to justify holding the jury list in the case of Barry Cadden. A lawyer for WBUR pointed that out at a recent motion to unseal the jury list. The judge responded that he would release the list, but not until after sentencing. He further stated that he would release the jurors' names and their towns or cities of residence, but that's not the same as an address. In the case of Bob Smith or Barbara Smith of Boston, for instance, a full address may be necessary to identify the individual. Again, Robert Birchie of the New England Newspaper and Press Association.
Giving the name and the city of Boston without a street address is really giving the illusion of access without the actual impact of access itself.
In a motion for reconsideration, WBUR argued last week that the ruling precedent called for the release of jurors' names at the end of the trial, not the end of sentencing, and for the release of both names and addresses unless there was a finding of significant threat. The trial of Barry Cadden has involved neither terrorists nor mobsters, but a pharmacist. In an order denying WBUR's motion, Judge Stern seemed to dismiss the 1990 opinion that has been considered the ruling precedent and the basis for the practice of releasing jury lists soon after trial. He called it a decades-old decision, written, quote, in a more innocent age. And without further reasoning or argument, he wrote, in the turbulent times in which we live, I would no more consider ordering the public disclosure of a juror's home address than I would my own. Nancy Gertner, who has co-authored The Law of Juries, now in its 9th edition, says that, as far as she knows, the law has not changed.
The law of this circuit is there's presumptive access.
A battle that erupted with an astonishing verdict form and a judge's failure to act is likely to rage this afternoon. But before anyone can find out who the jurors are to ask, what were they thinking?
That was WBUR senior reporter David Boeri.